Hello, welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast. I'm Bryson Newell, your host. This marks our two-year anniversary. We started the podcast in January, 2 years ago, and so I wanted to thank listeners for supporting us. I'm going to take a couple weeks off. However, I will replay an episode from season one, and that's episode being Dr. George Dreyfus. And we talk about science of mind, duality and non-duality of the mind-body, understanding in different Eastern and Western traditions, specifically Tibetan Buddhism, and then how that transfers or how we can understand that practicing somatics from a Western point of view. All right. And again, thank you everyone who has supported the show, and I hope you enjoy the episode, and I'll be back in 2 weeks.
Welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast with Bryson, an ongoing cross-discipline dialogue of all things somatics.
Hello, welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast. I'm your host, Bryson. Today on the show, I'm pleased to have Dr. George Dreyfus. Dr. Dreyfus is a professor of religious studies at Williams College in Massachusetts. His academic focus is in the fields of Tibetology and Buddhology, with a particular interest in Indian Buddhist philosophy, philosophy of mind, particularly the study of cognitive processes, theories of consciousness, the nature of attention, perception, and concept formation. In his early 20s, he traveled from Switzerland to Dharamshala, India. Once there, he spent more than a decade living in Dharamshala as a Buddhist monk, studying in their Geshe degree program. And then in 1985, he would become the first Westerner to graduate this program and receive the Geshe Larampa degree, which is the highest available degree within the Tibetan scholastic tradition. Dr. Dreyfus has written many books, among them The Sound of Two Hands Clapping, The Education of a Tibetan Buddhist Monk, and Recognizing Reality, Dharmakirti's Philosophy and Its Tibetan Interpretations. In this episode, we discuss his journey from Switzerland to India, how he came to be a Buddhist monk, what the daily life of a monk is like in Dharamshala, India, his interest in the philosophy of consciousness in Buddhism, meeting the Dalai Lama, the path of meditation in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. We also discuss how consciousness is understood in the Tibetan tradition, and also potential pitfalls and misunderstandings as Western students begin a meditation practice. I was delighted to have Dr. Dreyfus on the show, and I think this is a really important topic. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to the program, Dr. Dreyfus. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
I thought we could first start off with a little bit of your background. So what attracted you to the Tibetan tradition, and how you came to be to live in the monastery and start to study in the Geshe program?
I was not really interested in Buddhism when I was a kid. And then once I finished my high school, I'm from Switzerland, so once you finish high school in Switzerland, it's not like in the US where you go to college and then have 4 years to decide what you want to become. Rather, you have to decide right away when you're 18 or 19. What you want to do with your life. And I found that a little terrifying. And so I didn't quite know what to do with myself. So I decided I would take my backpack and hitchhike to India. I'm not sure exactly how this idea came. Mm-hmm. I first went to Turkey, and then in Turkey, I saw people going to India, and I thought, yeah, that's where I should go. So basically, I hitchhiked to India through Afghanistan, Pakistan. And then in India, I didn't quite know why I was there. And so I met some people in Benares, who told me about Tibetans the foothill of the Himalaya in Himachal Pradesh, Dharamsala, And so this is where I went. And there there was a teacher, Geshe Rabten, who would teach Westerners Buddhism. And this is how I became interested in studying Buddhism. Now, for me, I should make it clear that I studied Buddhism through Tibetan Buddhism, but my main interest is Buddhism, is not Tibetan Buddhism. Hmm. For me, what is essential is a basic insight of suffering and the origin of suffering and how to deal with suffering. And so this is what Buddhism for me is about. Hmm. And it's so I happened to encounter Buddhism through Tibetans. I think I could have encountered Buddhism through other forms of Buddhism as well. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I would pursue study, and as a well-educated person, I realized that I have to learn the language. And then, so I learned the language, then I ordained as a monk, and so I studied for about 15 years Tibetan Buddhism in Tibetan monasteries. And what did me more is what you could say called the philosophical aspect of Tibetan Buddhism. I was never that interested in Tantra and this aspect of Tibetan Buddhism, which is very important. But for me, what was most important is a basic Buddhist teaching and the Buddhist philosophy, which has been very well preserved by Tibetans. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if you have a general interest in Buddhism, not necessarily Tibetan, but that's the vehicle with which it was presented.
Exactly.
Their approach to the philosophy is quite different than the other schools, correct?
Yes and no. What is most different is, there are several particularities to Tibetan Buddhism. One is that they have preserved a very rich Indian Buddhist philosophical tradition, which is one aspect of Tibetan Buddhism, which is not unique to Tibetan Buddhism, because you find that also in China, but to a lesser degree. And so Tibetans have really is the tradition that has most that was able to preserve most of Indian Buddhist philosophy. Mm-hmm. So that's the aspect that really interests me the mm-hmm. most. Now, there is a completely different aspect, or largely different aspect, which is tantric practice, mm-hmm. which is something I'm less interested in, which mm-hmm. is also part of Tibetan Buddhism. And both these aspects are unique to Tibetan Buddhism for different reason, or maybe the same reason, which is that Tibetan Buddhism got transferred from India into Tibet much later than it did into Theravada countries like Sri Lanka or Burma or China and Japan. Mm-hmm. So Tibetan Buddhism the Buddhism arrived in Tibet late, like ninth century, mm-hmm. and really took shape in the 11th, 12th century. And so because of the accident of the transmission, Tibetans inherited a much different tradition from Chinese or Burmese or Sri Lankan, who inherited Buddhism at a much earlier stage of its development. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Tantra plays no role, or very little, at least explicitly, no role in Burmese or Sri Lankan Buddhism. which is Theravada, but it plays a little role in Chinese Buddhism, but a very large role in Tibetan Buddhism. And that's a function of the time scale at which Buddhism was arrived in the respective countries. Mm.
So that lined up real. So this is the Nalanda tradition we're essentially talking about that gets.
This is what the Dalai Lama calls the Nalanda yes. tradition, right? Mm. Now, this is his own term.
Right.
Yeah. The transmission that occurred between India and Tibet is actually quite complicated. Mm-hmm. And some of it comes from Nalanda. Most of it does not come from Nalanda. But it's a good name because Nalanda was probably the biggest university in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. Probably. I wouldn't stake my career on that. But I think because when you go to Nalanda, you see about 1 mile of university that has been, of buildings that have been unearthed. And mm-hmm. the people say there is another 6 miles. So mm-hmm. its apex must have been enormous. And so this was a great center of philosophical learning. And so Tibetans have inherited that. And so they can rightly claim that this is the Nalanda tradition because they have managed to preserve a large part of the Indian philosophical and religious tradition. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my training, I learned not just Buddhist philosophy, but also quite extensively several schools of Hindu philosophy. Mm-hmm. So the Tibetans have really kept this tradition alive, and obviously it has evolved and there are many transformations, but still it's a remarkable cultural achievement, and often people don't realize that mm-hmm. because they think Tibetan people are these wonderful simple people who live on top of the mountains. And they don't realize actually that they are quite, they have a very sophisticated intellectual tradition. And so when I went to grad school after the monastery, I didn't go to undergraduate, I went directly to grad school. And so my teachers, especially in philosophy, were quite impressed by my training, and I still remember a class where the professor of philosophy was screaming at me, and other students say, "How can you scream at George?" And the professor say, "Oh, don't worry, he can take it." So that was a real great compliment. And the reason I was pretty good at that is not because I'm that bright, but because I was marvelously trained by my teachers, because they were part of his great intellectual traditions, the tradition that Tibetans have. Mm. And I think that's not known enough, and I'm quite happy to talk about that.
Yeah, I agree completely. That's really one of the reasons why I wanted to have you, because it's this perspective is so rare, it seems like, unfortunately. So your teacher, Geshe Rabten, and who was your
It was my first teacher. I had many teachers.
Yeah. He was the one who introduced you to the Geshe program, though, and encouraged you to get involved in that?
That was gradual. No, he introduced me to basic Buddhism, basically the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. And then he told me, go and meditate and see how it works out. Didn't work out so well. But and then I went to see the Dalai Lama. I didn't really want to see him because I thought, who cares about famous people? Mm-hmm. And then turns out that he was actually quite impressive, which surprised me because, you know, I was a 60 person and I didn't like figures of authority like many people in the 60s, but he was very impressive. And so he told me, look, you have a choice between becoming a meditator or becoming a Buddhist scholar. So I chose the latter, and this is how I got gradually into the what you call the Geshe program.
And when he put these two options to you, what could you explain a little bit what the difference is between those two paths?
Becoming a meditator means, in his mind, going to finding a place in the forest, in the hills, where one is isolated, and then meditating like, I don't know if you could say 24/7, but a lot. And it works for some people and it doesn't work for some. I mean, it's hard. I mean, meditating half an hour a day or twice half an hour a day is okay. It's not too difficult. When I start my students in meditation, I tell them 10, 15 minutes. But if you become a meditator, this is like, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 hours a day. And, you know, many people are not built for that. And some people really, it goes really badly it can hurt you badly. Some people go crazy. I mean, this is not for the faint of heart. You really need to be well cut for this kind of, and then obviously once you get into it, then people say at the beginning they're really hard. And then after that, it gets really, really great. So this is what I call meditator. And then there are people like me who become scholars. We do a little bit of meditation. And so that's the second path.
Just to pause for a second on the meditation side, he wasn't suggesting that you would just go out by yourself. There would be some sort of format or a teacher provided some sort of education.
No. You have to work with a teacher. You have to gradually do it and so on. But this is, basically you go out on your own and you meditate with a teacher, with help and so on. But it's not. Now, this is one tradition. Another Tibetan tradition, the Kagyu, has this tradition of 3 years retreat in which you stay 3 years in a retreat. You are in a group. So often this is done in a group, but you meditate in your room by yourself for hours and hours as well. And then you have teachings from a meditation masters and so on. So there are different ways to do it, but that's what I meant by becoming a meditator. If you want a good idea of what this is, there is this book by an English nun called Cave in the Snow. That's she's a great meditator, and that's a really interesting book. That's her story about how she meditated. She was stuck by snow. She was afraid she would die of starvation and so on. So it's when I say meditator, it's really when the Dalai Lama, I should say, said meditator, he meant something serious.
Not a rugged, very rugged path.
And some people are cut for it, and some are simply not. And so if you're not cut for it, you better find a more gradual path.
And then, so you chose to do the scholarly side of things, which most would say this is a very rigorous path as well.
It is, but it's, it's doable. it's like climbing a very high mountain, but going, left, right, left, right. Whether the guys who climbed the steep wall, you know, like in the, I forgot the place where you can do that in America. So yeah, that's a difference, but yeah.
Okay. So could you tell us a little bit about how did you get started into this? And then what was this about? What was it like to live this? And what did you study?
What I study at different, first you get trained in the, one important part, as I say in my book, The Sound of Two Hands Clapping, is one very important part is debate. Mm-hmm. So you first learn how to debate, what are the terms, and so it takes about a year to train. Mm-hmm. And then once you have trained in debate, then you start learning, going through a different text that are considered foundational for the tradition. Mm-hmm. And so you take teachings from your teacher, you go to see him usually every day. And then after that, you go back to your room, you look at commentaries, and then you go in the evening debate. Mm-hmm. And that's how you say, and in the morning you memorize. Mm-hmm. So this is how you spend your whole day. And it's fun.
Yeah.
Because you're part of a class, and mm-hmm. so you're with your classmates, and it's kind of good humored and very lively. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people are familiar with this, that the Tibetans are debating, and there's sort of like there's a whole festivity about it. There's a competitive side.
It's very lively. It's like if you go on YouTube and watch Tibetan debate, you will be very surprised, because you see these monks who are screaming at each other and laughing and so on. And so, yeah, it's a really fun. And obviously, it's a good way to train the mind into being inquisitive at the same time as disciplined, because the problem of people who are inquisitive is that if you're inquisitive without any discipline, you don't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So you need to be inquisitive in a disciplined way so that your mind gets sharper and can deal with more and more difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And that's what basically the training in that was that about. And that's why when I went to grad school, I found the whole thing actually pretty easy compared to what I had done in the monastery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it seems there's a dichotomy here. Like in the morning, you're memorizing. It's all this kind of internal absorption of information. And in the evening, there's an outpouring. Like
Yeah. Well, it's also that memorizing first is very good for your mind. People in the old days used to memorize, and they were right. It's a really good discipline. Mm-hmm. Because it obliges you to pay attention to your mind. Mm-hmm. Because when you memorize, you have to get the habit of kind of monitoring your mind, because if you don't monitor your mind, your mind goes different places and it just doesn't work. So it's a very useful discipline. And so you learn how to memorize text, and then after that, you learn how to explain this text. And then finally in the evening, you let it all out and debate about this text. Mm-hmm. And so you are with your classmates, and then you debate sometimes several hours. Mm-hmm.
So it occurs to me these two different ways to work with the information or play with the information are in itself its own type of, I guess maybe we could say meditation, but at least mind training at the very least, like you said, you have
yes.
to.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The memorization actually is good for concentration, mm-hmm. because you learn how to monitor your attention. Mm-hmm. And the evening debate is good for what is most important in the Buddhist path, which is wisdom, meaning insight, understanding. And so you train your mind to inquire systematically. And because you have a very tight format, which you learned the first year, your inquiry is by necessity extremely disciplined, because you cannot just go left and right. You have to follow to make your arguments fit the form, the format mm-hmm. of the debate. And so that really makes you quite disciplined mm-hmm. in your inquiry. Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like somebody, because people are, I would imagine most people are completely unfamiliar with this. So we'll try to paint a picture here. Like playing a soccer game or something. You have a ball and you're not just doing whatever with it. There's specific rules to this game.
Like a chess game, but it's mm-hmm. physical as well. Right. It's like you have certain move. And mm-hmm. so you have to keep the format, and you cannot just move your pieces any way you want. Mm-hmm. And it's like I use the word chess because it's debates are also very strategic, because mm-hmm. you create a debate and you try to trick your adversary, and mm-hmm. your adversary is trying to see where you're going. Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of mind game.
Yeah. And there's an attacker and a defender, correct?
Yes, there is an attacker who is standing, and there is a defender who is sitting cross-legged on the ground. Mm-hmm. And so the defender, the attacker puts a question, and the defender has a number of set answers mm-hmm. that they can give.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's quite physical. So there's clapping and there's stomping and there's moving yes. around. There's a lot of excitement. Yes.
And that's very good, because it makes it much more lively, because, you know, we are embodied beings. And mm-hmm. so when we can mobilize our physicality, we get much more involved. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting tradition of learning, kind mm-hmm. of unique, which is inherited from India, but we don't really quite know how Indian debates proceeded. We know that debate was very important in India, but we don't, not quite sure how they proceeded. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then maybe we can focus in a little bit here on what's actually being debated. So what's this curriculum? What does the pedagogy kind of look like?
Well, the pedagogy I already explained. Mm-hmm. You memorize what's called the root text, which is a text in verse which summarizes the material. Mm-hmm. And then you go to see your teacher, who gives you explanations and expose you to various commentaries and various opinions on both what the text means, but also what are the difficult points that the text is talking about. And then you debate, and that's a pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And the text, there is one text about Buddhist metaphysics, if you want, about the whole Buddhist path. Mm-hmm. There is one text about epistemology and philosophy of language. There is one text about Madhyamika, which is the Buddhist Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. And then there is one text about the Abhidharma, which is it's a bit like a phenomenology, but it's in fact the origin of Buddhist philosophy. And then the last text is Vinaya, which is a monastic discipline. Mm-hmm. And so there is heavy emphasis on this philosophical topics, because texts 2 and 3 are basically only philosophy, and they take years to learn. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was most interested in myself in my studies.
Mm-hmm. And so you spent 15 years just on these texts?
Actually 12 years, but 12 yeah. Years.
Yeah. So this is a serious study.
Yes, though it was quick by Tibetan standards.
Oh, yes, I remember you said this quick. So you did 12 years. What's the typical duration this program?
I don't know, probably 15, 16. In Tibet, it would be 18, 20, mm-hmm. because people had to wait. Once they finished, they would only let go a few people at a time. So mm-hmm. So it was quick.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's way too much to delve into all these topics right here. So
oh yes,
yes, I would love to, maybe at another time.
Yes.
Piecemeal. But for today, can we talk a little bit about the mind in Tibetan Buddhism, or philosophy of mind, generally a topic not addressed too much in the West?
Yeah, it's obviously a very central topic of Indian philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's not just Buddhism.
Right.
It's other schools as well, especially, not just only. And so in India, there is a really rich tradition of philosophizing about the mind, which goes back maybe to the Upanishad, and then which is then carried on by the various schools of Indian Buddhism, among them the various schools of Buddhist philosophy, which each have their own particular views about the mind. Now, the origin of Buddhist views about the mind is found in the Abhidharma, which is basically an analysis of the various aspects of consciousness, mm-hmm. of the body too, but that's it's a very analysis of the body and mind, but mm-hmm. here we're talking about consciousness, so it's an analysis of the various aspects of consciousness. And so that's where the Buddhist philosophy of mind basically comes from this analysis of the various aspects of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And what the Buddhists particularly emphasize is the importance of not just cognitive aspect, but also, and maybe mostly, affective aspect. Mm-hmm. And that's very important for the practice of meditation, because the West tend to think about consciousness, the West, not everybody, obviously, but there is a strong tradition in the West of equating consciousness with thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a really problematic way of conceptualizing the mind, mm-hmm. both from a Indian or Buddhist point of view and from a modern scientific point of view. From a modern scientific point of view, it's pretty clear that consciousness is part of the evolution, and so thinking comes very late. We mm-hmm. can, there are debates about how late it comes, but certainly there are conscious form of life way before there is thinking. Mm-hmm. That's, and so it's a big mistake from a scientific point of view to think about consciousness as being about thinking, because it's primarily about bodiless awareness, right? Mm-hmm. Or embodied awareness, let's put it this way, mm-hmm. which has both a cognitive and an affective point of view. And so this is very important to understand, that the mind is not just this thinking kind of humanoid in our hand, but is really what allows us to move as biological beings, survive and deal adequately with our awareness. And particularly important is the way in which we pass things effectively. That is, every moment in which we are not in deep sleep, we automatically pass our experience as being either good, bad, or neutral. Mm-hmm. And that's an extremely important way the mind functions. And obviously, from it's like the Buddhist thinks it's like this from an observational point of view, if you want to say a phenomenological point of view. But obviously, if you think consciousness as being evolutionary, having an evolutionary function, then obviously assessing whether things are good or bad for the organism is the primary consideration of what consciousness is about, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you observe consciousness in meditation, you realize that consciousness is constantly passing experience automatically, right? It's good, bad, and many of our thought comes as reaction to this affective evaluation, which happens at a much lower level of consciousness. Right? Mm-hmm. It's not something we think. Thinking comes after. First, there is this kind of parsing of what's going on. Is it good, bad? Is it dangerous? Is it not dangerous? Should I go ahead? Should I not go ahead? This kind of level of evaluation. And so that's, if you want, the ground level at which consciousness starts, both from what you can observe in meditation mm-hmm. and what makes sense from a scientific point of view.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And so this is just a felt experience that doesn't need thoughts at all to determine good, bad, or neutral.
Yes, it doesn't need any thought. Mm-hmm. And then thoughts kicks in. And
as a result,
it kind of evaluate or mm-hmm. start to worry, hope, all mm-hmm. these things. Now, between thoughts and evaluation, you have often more kind of primitive reaction like desire or aversion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because your automatic reaction when something bad happens is to have aversion to that.
Mm-hmm.
And your automatic is a tricky word that maybe I shouldn't use. There is a kind of gut level reaction that happened. It's automatic in a way, we don't control it, but it's conscious.
Yeah.
And so it's part of the content of consciousness that you react to the stimuli by evaluating them. And then after this evaluation, you have very often this kind of gut level desire or aversion, right? Mm-hmm. Or if it's neutral, nothing happens. And then this leads to what I would call judgment, right? In which mm-hmm. thinking start to kick in and evaluate. Suddenly in my mind comes this idea of marzipan chocolate. Then I have this, I want it. And mm-hmm. then I start to think, okay, what do I need to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I think is important to understand in the Buddhist understanding of consciousness, which is that consciousness is not just this thinking part of your mind, but involves a much lower level of mentation, which is essential to who we are, because we are not thinkers prisoner of a body, right?
Right.
We are embodied being, and that's who we are, for the better or for the worse. It has good and bad aspects, but that's That's not the point. This is who we are, right?
Right.
And consciousness is part of, is an essential element of this condition. And so consciousness is embodied.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, what is very important to understand about consciousness.
Mm. And so you're
and
coming...
That's why people in the West, not everybody, but many thinkers in the West earlier on, but up to fairly recently, thought that animals have no consciousness, which from an Indian point of view makes absolutely no sense, because obviously animals have consciousness, they have sensation, they have fears, they have desire, they have anger, they have not the same thing we have. The question of how they think is a complicated question. But they certainly have some forms of thinking. And so it's extremely important to understand that consciousness is not just thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It covers the whole range of what embodiment is about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so this is a central question here. So because of the way the Indian tradition or the Tibetan tradition thinks about consciousness, you're being raised in this culture with these ideas, but then somebody coming from the West, it's easy to think consciousness is thoughts.
Yeah, but you know, you can change. But it's interesting that Tibetans, when you ask, where is your mind?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know nowadays, but when I was among Tibetans, would always say, here,
in
your
heart. Chest.
In your chest.
Yeah.
Never here.
Never in the head. A
Westerner would say, well, obviously it's here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I don't know what young Tibetans nowadays would say. I have no idea because, you know, things change in Asia too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So I have no idea.
So was this a big transition for you?
Well, you know, the whole thing was a big transition. So, so this is just one part of it. This is not exactly what was the biggest, you know, I had to learn the language. I had to learn how to behave, as a Tibetan and, So, you know, this was my life, and I'm a very adaptable person.
Mm.
So I adapt readily. And so, no, that was not particularly. Basically, my understanding of consciousness has kept evolving because I teach nowadays about consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I have several courses about consciousness. And so, I have constantly refined my way of understanding, and also in dialogue with several interesting, there are interesting people in the West who think about consciousness. Not everybody is thinking about consciousness as thinking.
Mm-hmm.
There are also some interesting people, for example, Damasio is a neuroscientist who have a way of thinking about the consciousness, which stresses this kind of embodiment and primitive level of consciousness. And they're also interesting phenomenologists like Husserl and Merleau-Ponty. So it's not like that in the West everybody is wrong and knows nothing about it.
Right.
But it is a case that in Western philosophy, most professors, if you ask what consciousness is, will tend to present it as some form of thinking.
Right. And I think a student to meditation or to these traditions that approaches with that, I think it seems like it could set them off on a totally different path than is meant to be.
Well, I think if you meditate in the right way, you quickly realize mm-hmm. what's actually going on, which is pretty different from when you thought was going on, because right. you thought that you were this kind of thinker who was trying to get by and orient themselves and so on. Mm-hmm. Whereas in fact, you have this body which is constantly being interacting with the environment and mm-hmm. and creating reaction in you, and then you actually you're following your mind. You're not the one in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what is most important about meditation, is to learn how to be in charge. And you can be in charge only if you are aware of how your mind really functions. So if you start meditating, you quickly get the picture that thinking is not really what consciousness is all about. It's a really relatively small part of consciousness, but there is a whole different level, which is much more primitive and much more powerful, and that actually your thinking is reacting to that much mm-hmm. more powerful aspect of consciousness, and is not in charge at all. And the way you become in charge is by becoming aware of your more gut level reaction, and that gives you a path to break the kind of automatic chain between the affective evaluation, the reaction. And then once you become more aware, you can start to break the chain and reorient your thinking, because now you know what's coming up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, at least in the Buddhist tradition, if you really start to meditate in the right way, you quickly get the picture that you're not really in charge, and that you really need to work to be in charge, because the embodied mind is extremely powerful, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, it has hundreds of millions of years of experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you are this little thin guy in your head who thinks he knows everything and so on. And it's like, you have no idea.
Yeah.
And so meditation is a way for you to understand your embodied condition and who you are,
mm-hmm.
which is not this little guy in the head, but which mm-hmm. is this embodied being.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we can take these two, return to the pedagogy for a second and talk about perspective. So when you're doing a memorization, you're using the little guy. Is yes. this correct?
Yeah.
And then when you're in debate, you're using the more primal?
No, you're using the little guy too. You're losing the little guy, but you're also trying to muster energy from the big guy.
Yeah. So it's a mixing.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're really enthusiastic about something, it's like the big guy and the small guy work together.
They work together.
Yeah. And so meditation is really a way for you to be sure that the big guys, that you can use the big guy for the purpose that you want.
Mm-hmm.
Because the big guys can take you in really terrible places, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the big guy is in power
mm-hmm.
until you start applying the right kind of discipline that allows you to become aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then once you become aware, then you have the space to reorient mm-hmm. your very powerful embodied consciousness, right? All these kind of gut level emotions, which mm-hmm. are very important, but which can take us in very, very dark places, right? Mm-hmm.
So we're looking for some sort of better information and then trying to strike some sort of harmony.
We're looking for awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, thinking in the right way. Once you're aware, then you can reorient your thinking.
Right.
When I left the monastery, my teacher told me, if you follow your mind, things will never work out. But if the mind follows you, then you will be much happier.
Mm-hmm.
You will lead a much better life. And that's, I think, what a lot of Buddhist meditation is about, and the Hindu as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is learning how to become aware of the mind mm-hmm. in an experiential way and creating that space of freedom in which you're not compelled to follow all your pulsions and all your reactions and can start to sift through things and encourage the good, positive reaction like loving kindness and compassion and this kind of positive emotions and kind of downplay and undermine the negative emotion like hatred, jealousy, and so on, which don't take you anywhere except in to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the whole, in a way, the whole tradition is about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so observing your mind, being attentive to your mind is really the central element of Buddhist practice.
Mm-hmm. And for a little more clarification on this, the difference between mind awareness and thoughts.
Well, thought is part of mind. For me, I use the word mind as the totality.
Right.
I mean, yeah, the totality. Now, part of mind that not conscious,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be okay. We could even use mind as including conscious and non-conscious operations. Or maybe we can limit the word mind to what's conscious. It doesn't matter. But anyway, within consciousness, thought is a very small part.
Mm-hmm.
Is a relatively small part of what we're conscious of, right? Mm-hmm. Because at all, most of the time, we are conscious of what's happening with our body, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are conscious of our, for example, when we move around, mm-hmm. we are conscious of our body, right? Because if we were not conscious on our body, we could not move. Mm-hmm. We would fall.
Mm-hmm.
So we are conscious of our body when we move. Now, when I sit down, am I conscious of my body? Well, sometimes, sometimes not. If I am extraordinarily absorbed into something else, I might lose consciousness, awareness right. of my body. Now, that kind of awareness is a kind of subliminal awareness, but it's part of the content of consciousness mm-hmm. very, very clearly. And so that's what you learn how to observe in the practice of meditation.
So the body sensations and stuff like and these sorts.
Yeah, that's very important. Mm-hmm. Body sensation in meditation is extremely important because that's most of the time where it starts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can be aware of your bodily sensation, then you give yourself a chance of not reacting automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem is that if we're not aware, which is just part of consciousness, but it's kind of liminal part of consciousness. It's like mm-hmm. it's like under the grass, right? It's like a snake under the grass. Mm-hmm. And then it leads you to react
mm-hmm.
in very negative ways. And then once you have strong emotions like anger,
mm-hmm.
It's hard to stop yourself because mm-hmm. that's the content of your consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're mindful of the sensation, then you can break the chain.
Mm-hmm.
And once you break the chain, then you're much freer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not very useful to be angry.
Right.
It's much more useful to take appropriate action, whatever is happening.
Right.
But that takes a lot of practice to be aware of one's, if you want to say, gut level reactions.
Mm-hmm. So it occurs to me as we're walking, we can be thinking of something we have to do later in the day, somewhere we have to be,
yes,
whatever, and we're still able to walk, but we're really not embodied in the sense that we're feeling the sensations of our feet or the way our hips are moving in the hip joints, anything like this.
No, but your mind is monitoring the whole thing, and it is in your awareness. It's just you don't realize it's
You're
in
distracted.
Your awareness. Because if it were not in your awareness, you would fall.
Right.
There is a condition in which people have, this is called proprioceptive awareness,
yes.
Right? And there is a condition in which people lose proprioceptive awareness and proprioceptive self-awareness, and they cannot walk. The only way they can walk is by looking at their feet and guiding their feet like you would guide
right.
an object.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the internal feeling that walking, that allows walking, right?
Mm-hmm.
This constant kind of feedback, back and forth between your brain and your whole body, which is constantly going on. If you don't have that, then you can't walk.
Right, but you have to think it.
Yeah, you have to think
which
it.
Which is obviously much less efficient.
Yeah, this is not how a healthy organism functions, right?
Right.
This is after a stroke or things like that. It's a really, really bad condition because you're very prone to fall. And obviously, it's very inefficient to have to mobilize the whole of your mind to just walk, right?
Mm-hmm. So part of the practice of meditation is to cultivate, I guess you could call it being in the present moment, as far as like what am I doing with the body and cultivating sensation.
And paying special attention to your sensation, because often mental emotion starts with bodily sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you pay attention to your bodily sensation, that's a really good way to anchor your awareness so that you are not caught by the automatic reactions, but you are able to break the chain as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you are angry, it's hard to break the chain.
Yeah.
Or desire is even more powerful, right? Because desire comes in and then it's like, it's there, right? And it's in your mind.
You.
And it's like, then now you engage in a fight with your mind. And that's not fun.
Yeah.
And that's hard. And usually desire wins because you push back desire for 10, 15 minutes. Then after 20 minutes, it's back.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to start all over again and so on. And so that's because you have not been able to break the chain before or early enough to prevent it from really taking over the whole space of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so if you're presented a meditation practice and that's your understanding of it, it seems like it's going to be nothing but frustration for you.
Yes.
You have a hard time moving through that into the bodily sensations, because quite honestly, I don't hear that as a primary topic of investigation by a lot of meditation teachers.
The different meditation teachers have different, but I think it's bodily sensation is extremely important, because it's usually a good way to catch things early. Let's put
right.
it like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My assumption here is that you got a culture that's quote unquote more embodied coming into contact with a culture that's not so embodied, that's more thinking. And then when those teachings, maybe this isn't explicit in a lot of the teachings for this new kind of meditator.
Yeah, I think in a way you're right. I think traditional people, not just Asian, but people who lived in a traditional pre-modern society were probably much more in contact with the whole embodiment sensation and so on, because obviously our education tend to really emphasize the thinking part, because we have, there's so many things to learn, and this has very good, this is very positive, but it does mean that it puts us in our head more mm-hmm. than people who belong to a society in which schooling was much rarer and much shorter.
Or you have like putting kids inside of, you know, put them in a room and a desk versus being in nature or some sort of a doing apprenticeship where you're working with your hands or embodiment. You, it's survival, right? You step on a snake or something's coming after you.
Yes, like,
this is a mandatory function of the human being in a natural environment where in
that's right.
You can,
and obviously social. I'm not even talking about social media, which is
right
bringing enormous change to the human mind. Right, this is. I mean, I can speak about schooling because that's what I've done, but social media doesn't affect me very much because I am already an old person. And so, you know, somebody doesn't like me on Facebook, that's not the end of that's not the end of the world. But I think that it affects young people in very profound way and very dangerous way.
Yeah. Well, even more hyper-focused on the thought part of mind.
Focus on the thought and constantly looking for kind of affirmation from the outside world. And that's really, that's why you have a lot of depression among young people. Among my students, there is a level of depression which is did not exist 20 years ago even. So I think, this is bringing real changes to how, and obviously social media is not very good for attention either, because what you need to learn in attention, to cultivate attention, is to monitor your attention, not to react to any little stimulus, because then what you build is the habit of being addicted to constant flow of stimulus. And that's very destructive of your capacity of attention, because your capacity of attention comes your ability to monitor your mind and to direct it to the object that you want it to go to. And so this kind of cell phone is really extraordinarily destructive. And I think for young minds, it's really making the psyche much more fragile and much less weakened the level of attention, which is not good for doing anything. I remember being at the meeting and the person was asking, what kind of app do we need for attention? And I was saying, no, you don't need an app. You need to shut your phone and start to monitor your mind. If you want to develop attention, that's a way to do it.
So in the West, we have this idea, this concept, embodiment, and this word embodiment. Is there a term for this? Does the Tibetans have a term for this, or just like I said,
implicit? Not a very important term, embodiment in Tibetan or in Buddhist, but there is a lot of paying attention to the body and so on. So I think it's not exactly a matching. There is no now embodiment is an interesting term, because embodiment doesn't mean having a body, but it means being a body, right?
That's paying attention to the body.
Yeah, Now, there is not really this concept in Buddhism or Hinduism, but there is a lot of attention paid to the body through sensation, because in Buddhist meditation, in mindfulness, sensation plays a very important role, because they are your earliest warning that something is happening, right? Right. And so through that, people pay a lot of attention to what's happening in the body at the level of sensation and experience of the body. So it's kind of embodiment, but that concept does not really exist.
Yeah, but, well, it doesn't need to. It's the idea that's what's happening. So call it whatever you want.
And there are many practices in Tibetan Buddhism concerning the body.
Can you share some of those?
Not really, because I don't know them very much. This is what I call the tantric aspect of the tradition. Right?
Like this is like the salong or prana or different.
Yeah, this kind of thing. And I don't want to talk about it because I really don't know very much about it. Sure. That's not the aspect of Tibetan Buddhism that has interested me. But that's, if you are interested in embodiment, that's obviously a very interesting site of inquiry. In my own in what I have encountered, I think that this aspect of the tradition has yet to be adequately theorized from a philosophical point of view, if you want to say, because it's understood as a set of practices. And there is not a whole lot of philosophy that revolves around it. And so I think there is ample room for inquiry, but I'm not the person to do that.
This is mostly in the retreatant path.
Yeah, this is people who practice. I mean, you know, it's a difficult set of practice. It's a very advanced set of practice. And obviously, it does involve a whole, it does imply a whole theory of about how the human body, how the human are embodied, right? And how the body and the mind are kind of connected, or better put, are together, right? And so they have this concept of gross body and subtle body and so on, but I'm not sure what we do with them from a Western scientific point of view, because it's not like if we open the body, we are going to find this subtle body.
Right.
It's more like a kind of phenomenological body, but I don't think this has been theorized appropriately, and I'm certainly not the person to do that because I don't really do this kind of practice.
Right. We find, though, like in Theravada practice, and we find walking meditation.
Yes.
Just an intense mindfulness to eating, drinking, and you have debate. So it's there, even if it's not explicit.
No, obviously, but I was talking about tantra, right? Where the idea of embodiment is taking further than in the exoteric tradition, right? Where you talk about sensation of the body, paying attention to the body behavior and so on, but in tantra, you have a way in which you work with your body and your mind together, right? And so that's more kind of theory of embodiment, but this is not really well theorized from a Western point of view.
Yeah, and as you say this, it's like to present these practices of somebody who are quote unquote disembodied would make no sense. It was like, it would be better to really begin to become aware of your sensations and walking and just basic levels of awareness of your body.
Yeah, that's for sure. These practices are difficult. They're also dangerous because, you know, once you start to work with the end let's call that energy, because we don't really know what we're talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. So bodily energy, things can go really badly. Mm-hmm. And so you better work with somebody who knows what they are doing.
Right.
And you obviously need to be yourself a relatively advanced practitioner, because mm-hmm. otherwise things are not going to work.
Yeah, it seems like if we could sort of just put it in a regular anatomy, it's like trying to do things with the nervous system with now and understanding yeah. the basic anatomy of the skeleton, the muscles.
Yes. Meditation already is not without its own set of dangers.
Yeah.
So because you are dealing with not with your body per se, but you're dealing with your attention.
Yeah.
And so once you start changing the pattern of attention, you better make sure that you're changing that in the right way, because otherwise bad things can happen too. Mm-hmm. So all these practices at different levels obviously do need careful guidance and dealing with the right people, because they're not dangerless. Mm-hmm. And so when I teach meditation at school, which I didn't used to do, I thought this is too much Buddhist, but this is a new century, right? So now I teach meditation. And so I insist on that students pay very great attention to that. And if they feel there is any problem, for example, people who have trauma can have bad experience with meditation. And mm-hmm. so it's important to deal with this in a kind of skillful way, because otherwise things can go wrong.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that meditation's done in context of an education system. So when you were studying in meditating, you were also studying texts that were helping you, and you had teachers moving you along the right direction, instead of just extracting mindfulness or meditation out and just somebody who has no experiences have at it. Like we said, they could just get lost in thoughts.
Yeah.
Become even more mindful of their negative or traumatic thoughts.
Yeah. Trauma is a really very delicate thing, because meditation can reopen trauma, can reactivate traumatic experiences. And so that's a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people need tools.
Yeah, and I think what meditation centers need to be more aware that this is a delicate thing. And I think it's all the more true for this present generation of students who are much more delicate than past generations. Mm-hmm. You know, my generation was not as strong as the World War II generation, but we were still part of a pretty stable society. Mm-hmm. And so this produced a psyche which was relatively stable, and you could even see sometime too stable. But now it's now the society has become much more unstable, creating a much greater degree of uncertainty and anxiety and so on. And that's not very good for young minds who are growing up and need to be protected and so on. And so that creates a different, and obviously social media is making things much, much worse. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then finally, so after the program, you had the option of staying on or leaving?
Oh, I could have stayed on. I could have gone to do my tantric studies. Mm-hmm. But that's not what I did, and I chose to become a boring professor. And here we are.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It was an honor getting to talk to you. I really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. All the best.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.